Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to being truly well-informed, packed with surprising facts and engaging insights. I'm Chris Vanderbilt, and I'm thrilled to be your guide today.
And I'm Alex Astor, ready to help you connect the dots and understand what truly matters in the information we're exploring.
Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into the very latest from Barron's Magazine for the week of August 11th, 2025.
Right.
We've got an incredibly rich stack of articles and analyses from this issue, covering everything from dramatic shifts in economic policy to the wild world of cryptocurrency.
Always wild.
Always wild, yeah.
Yeah.
The intricate dance of family businesses, the surprising dynamics of defense stocks, and critical insights into your investment strategies.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission today is to thoroughly unpack each and every one of these topics, dissecting the impact and implications of the latest financial and economic news, so you can walk away feeling thoroughly informed and ready to navigate the landscape.
That's right. Barron's, for those unfamiliar, is a sister publication to the Wall Street Journal, published by Dow Jones and Company since, well, 1921.
Wow, long time.
Yeah. It's renowned for its deep coverage of U.S. financial information, market developments, and relevant statistics. It's a fantastic lens through which to examine what's moving markets and shaping our financial lives.
Okay.
Let's begin by pulling back the curtain on this week's cover story, which paints a complex economic picture.
We'll start by unpacking the economic landscape Barron's lays out for us this week, which is certainly complex, featuring inflation on the rise, growth slowing, and markets showing some real, you know, frothiness.
Definitely.
The first major piece that grabbed our attention is titled, Inflation is Rising, Growth is Slowing, and Stocks are Bubbly. What could go wrong?
Ominous.
A little bit. The article pinpoints the July Consumer Price Index, or CPI, release as a pivotal moment for interest rates, currency, and equity markets.
Right.
Joe Light from Piper Sandler refers to it as a moment of truth on tariffs, anticipating an uptick in core goods prices due to import fees. Specifically, the article projects a 0.3% rise in overall core CPI and a 0.2% rise in the headline number.
Okay.
For listeners, the core CPI excludes volatile food and energy prices, giving a clearer picture of underlying inflation trends, while the headline CPI includes, well, everything. What's particularly intriguing here is this seasonal adjustment paradox with gas prices that Deutsche Bank economists highlighted.
Yes.
They estimated 2.4% seasonally adjusted decline in gas prices, which could artificially depress the headline CPI number.
Right. Which sounds counterintuitive for summer, doesn't it?
Exactly. This is interesting because typically summer demand drives gas prices up. A seasonal adjustment factors the normal seasonal rise out of the data.
Got it.
So if actual prices stay flat, but the model expected them to rise, a flat price can actually register as a decline after that seasonal adjustment is applied.
Artificially making headline CPI look lower than the reality at the pump suggests.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
And this is despite the fact that AAA observed virtually no change in the nationwide pump price, which has been holding steady at $3.15 a gallon.
Okay.
When you look at the year-over-year changes, those expected monthly increases would lift the headline CPI to 2.8% and core CPI to 3.0%, marking a move in the wrong direction from the Fed's 2% target.
Definitely the wrong direction. A key takeaway here is how the market seems to be potentially underestimating these economic signals.
Mm.
When we look at the broader economic trend, we're seeing growth slowing to below 2%, which, combined with prices rising closer to a 3% annual pace, truly suggests a stagflation-late scenario.
Stagflation-late, okay.
But yeah, this is far from the robust growth we'd prefer to see. And it's not just the CPI. The Producer Price Index, or PPI, due out later in the week, is also expected to show increases, further indicating inflationary pressures, likely from tariffs.
More pressure.
Considering these conflicting signals, the immediate question for the Fed is how much flexibility they truly have. A higher-than-forecast CPI report could significantly reduce the Federal Reserve's room to cut interest rates at its upcoming September meeting.
Makes sense.
Despite this looming pressure, the CME FedWatch site showed an 89.4% probability of a quarter-point rate reduction as of Friday.
Still that high, even with this data.
Still that high. That figure was largely unchanged even after weak July employment data came out.
Interesting.
This surprising optimism leaves room for a potential Treasury sell-off if CPI surprises to the upside, a risk reinforced by recent weak bond options that reminded markets of the huge public debt to GDP ratios.
Now, this is where the plot thickens. Despite all these economic warnings, the stock market continued its advance.
Just keeps climbing.
The NASDAQ composite hit a new record, and the S&P 500 was flirting with its own high. This article describes the market as bubbly, pointing to heating up IPOs and sky-high valuations for tech darlings like Palantir.
Oh, yeah.
Which is trading at an astonishing 100 times revenue.
About 100 times. Wow.
So what does this apparent market complacency mean for investors?
Well, this phenomenon connects directly to what Julian Emanuel from Evercore ISI describes as a twice-in-a-lifetime experience.
Okay.
He draws striking parallels to the dot-com bubble, reminding us that even then, there were significant pullbacks before the final surge.
No, people forget that.
Exactly. His call for a 7% to 15% pullback into October suggests that while the current momentum is strong, smart investors might consider hedging their positions.
Hedging how?
He's essentially advising a strategy of buying put options on a fund like the Invesco QQQ, which tracks the NASDAQ 100, or maybe replacing some stock holdings in big winners like NVIDIA or Amazon with call options.
Oh, okay. Limiting the downside.
Exactly. This strategy limits potential loss while preserving upside, offering a way to manage risk in a, well, frothy market. It makes one wonder, are we witnessing a late summer melt-up before a fall swoon?
A late summer melt-up.
Hmm.
The market's remarkable resilience despite these headwinds is captivating. It's almost as if the prevailing sentiment is C is for complacency. And that seems good enough for the stock market.
It does feel that way sometimes.
The article, Terrorists Be Damned, Stocks Flirt with a New Record High, really hammers this point home, highlighting the market's complacency in shrugging off concerns about tariffs in a weakening labor market.
Yeah.
The SIBO Volatility Index, or VIX, often called the market's fear gauge, trading around 16, indicates a distinct absence of fear among investors.
16 is pretty low historically.
It is. From your perspective, what stands out about this seemingly irrational optimism?
Well, one striking detail here is the sheer bullish conviction that continues to drive this market. Analysts like Frank McKiernan from Third View Private Wealth believe the S&P 500 could hit 6,900 by year end.
6,900, wow.
Yeah, which would be about 8% higher than current levels. He attributes this optimistic outlook to strong corporate earnings and a favorable policy environment stemming from, you know, expected rate cuts from the Fed, combined with lower taxes and deregulation from the Trump administration.
Okay, the policy angle.
Right. This confluence of factors, he argues, should significantly boost profits next year. This view is further supported by the reignition of the Magnificent Seven trade.
Back again.
Back again. Referring, of course, to the powerhouse tech giants like Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, Meta, NVIDIA, and Tesla, signaling a renewed appetite for risk among investors.
Mm-hmm.
The critical takeaway here is that despite potential economic headwinds, a segment of the market is betting heavily on strong earnings and supportive policy to override concerns.
Okay.
The challenge for investors then becomes understanding how long this complacency can sustain itself when economic signals suggest a more complex reality.
This brings us to a crucial debate, one that's actively discussed in Barron's mailbag section, where readers weigh in on Federal Reserve independence.
Oh, always a hot topic.
Definitely. There's a strong sentiment that the Fed should make decisions based on what is best for America as a whole, rather than being swayed by political pressures.
Right, the independence issue.
Exactly. The fear is that a politically appointed MAGA loyalist could goose the economy for partisan gain, ignoring long-term stability.
Hmm.
This concern is directly connected to the risk of double-digit inflation and double-digit unemployment seen in the Nixon era if the Fed's independence is compromised.
A historical warning, yeah.
And speaking of concerns about economic data, this takes us to another critical debate. Does the CPI truly reflect inflation? Some on Wall Street have serious doubts.
Yes. The article, Does CPI Reflect True Inflation? Some on Wall Street Have Doubts, dives into this directly. It highlights how changes in CPI calculation methods, like replacing actual house prices with owner's equivalent rent back in the 1980s.
Right, OER.
OER, exactly, have systematically dampened reported inflation. This change essentially smooths out the volatility of housing market prices by estimating what homeowners would pay to rent their own home.
Which isn't quite the same as buying a house.
Not at all. It often results in a lower, less volatile reported inflation rate than if actual home purchase prices were included. Robert Arnott from Research Affiliates points out that under old methods, COVID-era inflation would have registered a 19.5% surge.
19.5%?
Yeah, worse than the early 1980s peak of 14.7%, which prompted the Fed to hike rates to 20%.
Wow. That puts it in perspective.
It really does. The market for Treasury inflation-protected securities, or TIPS, valued at $2.1 trillion, relies on trust in CPI data. If that trust erodes due to perceived manipulation, demand for TIPS could decrease, affecting their pricing and yield. This connects to the broader bond market, where impaired trust in CPI data could steepen the Treasury yield curve, requiring higher compensation for long-term U.S. debt.
Okay.
The article even suggests alternative hedges like gold if CPI is perceived as manipulated, as its compensation doesn't rely on official data.
Right, a real asset.
Exactly. The critical insight here is that when official data like CPI is perceived as misrepresenting reality, it can erode trust in core financial metrics, pushing savvy investors towards real assets like gold, which don't rely on government-reported numbers for their intrinsic value. It's effectively a vote of no confidence in official economic narratives.
Transitioning from economic data to trade policy, Barron's also covered the tech tariffs arrive. Why 100% levies had 0% impact.
Ah, yes, the tariffs.
This piece discusses the long-awaited 100% tariff on chips and semiconductors announced by President Trump. But here's the crucial detail that explains the 0% impact.
The exemption.
The exemption. If you're building in the United States or have committed to build here, there will be no charge.
Right.
This explains why Apple rallied 3.2% and the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, or SOX, was up 1.5% despite the initial uncertainty. Apple, it seems, is likely a recipient of this largesse, benefiting from its significant U.S. manufacturing presence or commitments.
Makes sense for Apple.
So what are the broader implications here? The definition of chips and semiconductors has been elastic, and these exemptions for companies committed to building in the U.S. create a lot of questions. How will this impact supply chains and pricing, especially for companies like TSMC building in Arizona, which already project higher costs than in Taiwan?
Yeah, that's a huge question. This brings to mind a crucial point about fairness and economic logic. If U.S. customers end up paying 5% to 20% more for Arizona-made chips,
which they might,
they very well might, it could potentially backfire on the very onshoring goal it aims to achieve, making American-made chips less competitive globally in the long run. Furthermore, the article points out the complex web of deals with the EU, South Korea, and Japan, which will impose varying tariff rates. For example, the EU faces a 15% tariff on semiconductors, and South Korea is expected to have a similar rate. Japan also has a similar arrangement, though it's not confirmed by the U.S. side. The biggest uncertainty still looms over AI servers, which are currently exempt from some tariffs, but not the new 100% Section 232-1.
So AI servers are caught in the middle.
It seems so. No one, not even Wall Street, has a clear idea of the full implications yet, creating a significant fog of uncertainty for companies navigating these complex trade waters.
Right.
Ultimately, this tariff story isn't just about trade wars. It's a stark reminder of the delicate balance in industrial policy. While aimed at onshoring, it highlights how well-intentioned policies can paradoxically inflate costs for consumers or even undermine global competitiveness if not carefully executed.
So we've seen how traditional economic indicators are painting a complex picture. Now let's venture into a world that often seems to defy traditional economics altogether.
Yeah.
The wild west of cryptocurrency.
Here we go.
Starting with the cover story. Everyone is long for the crypto ride now, even if it ends badly. This article paints a vivid picture of a dramatic shift in Washington's stance on crypto.
A really dramatic shift.
It describes an unthinkable midsummer White House gathering where crypto executives previously under investigation were celebrated. One crypto executive even famously stated, "We're winning."
Quite a statement.
It signals President Trump's radical shift in opinion from calling crypto based on thin air and a scam in his first term to becoming a crypto president after making millions from Trump digital trading cards and his company, DJT, disclosing $2 billion in Bitcoin holdings.
Yeah, the turnaround is stunning.
The practical effects of this shift are quite significant. The SEC has dropped cases against major firms like Coinbase, Kraken, and Robinhood.
Big names.
And even attempted to reverse a judgment against Ripple, though that specific move was rejected by a judge.
An intriguing aspect of this report is the rapid regulatory pivot we're witnessing. Banking regulators withdrew Biden-era guidance that had previously restricted banks from dealing with digital asset firms.
Okay, so opening the doors.
Pretty much. And they're now actively encouraging traditional financial institutions to dive into the crypto space.
This makes me wonder, why are major banks like Bank of America, Citigroup, and JP Morgan Chase, whose CEO once called Bitcoin a Ponzi scheme?
Right, Jamie Dimon. Exactly. Why are they now considering stablecoins and offering Bitcoin ETF-backed loans? This is a dramatic change that signals deep integration of crypto into the mainstream financial system, potentially opening the floodgates for wider adoption.
But adoption comes with risks, right?
Absolutely. This mainstream adoption also comes with risks. The new stablecoin law, for example, requires one-to-one backing by safe assets like treasury bills.
Which sounds good on paper.
It does. But concerns remain, as Amanda Fisher from Better Markets highlighted, about the risk of widespread stablecoin use in payments. She cited Circle's USDC dropping to 88 cents during the Silicon Valley Bank failure.
I remember that scary moment.
Yeah. Emphasizing the potential for a logistical nightmare for small businesses and the tremendous pressure on the government to bail it out if a stablecoin lost significant value.
Mm.
Ironically, she argues, past regulatory discouragement actually concentrated risk by limiting banking partners for crypto firms, making a bailout more likely, not less.
Interesting paradox. Beyond just payments, crypto is pushing into even more traditional areas of American life, like retirement savings and even home mortgages. It's quite the expansion.
That's right. The Labor Department rescinded guidance warning against crypto in 401k plans, and President Trump signed an order to ease access to crypto and retirement savings.
Wow. 401k.
And even more provocatively, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, or FHFA, is studying allowing crypto assets to count towards home borrowers' assets for mortgages.
Crypto for a mortgage down payment.
Potentially. This certainly raises an important question about the implications for housing market stability, particularly given crypto's historic volatility and illiquidity compared to traditional assets like stocks.
Definitely volatile.
Democratic senators have specifically highlighted this as a significant risk to the financial system, pointing out that illiquid assets can be hard to convert to cash quickly, posing risks in a housing downturn.
Yep. That makes sense.
The industry's next target appears to be tokenized securities, essentially stocks trading 24/7 on blockchains.
Okay, so like bypassing traditional exchanges.
In a way, yeah. That's the idea. Kraken is already offering these to non-US investors, and Coinbase seeks regulatory relief. Proponents argue for lower trading costs, increased transparency, and faster settlement.
Sounds efficient.
Maybe. However, traditional finance trade groups, such as SIFMA and the Healthy Markets Association, are sounding alarm bells, warning of fragmented equities markets and the circumvention of securities rules.
Right, the potential downsides.
They draw stark parallels to past financial crises, like the collapse of Archegos Capital Management and the 2010 flash crash, both linked to unregulated equity derivatives. The core concern is that without proper oversight, these innovations could introduce new systemic risks.
Paul Grukal of Coinbase argues that past crypto crashes didn't require government intervention or bailouts. What does the White House say about putting in place crypto-specific regulations where previously there were none?
Well, a White House official noted to Barron's that the new stablecoin law requires one-to-one backing, audits, and anti-money laundering standards, arguing these are necessary consumer protections as a lot of the tech in this space is going to undergird what the new financial system looks like.
Okay, so they see it as foundational.
Seems like it. This makes me wonder, how do we effectively balance innovation with necessary consumer and systemic protections? Especially when the administration is pushing for regulatory sandboxes that would allow crypto firms to test products outside full regulation.
Right, the sandbox idea.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, speaking to crypto executives, even declared, if you're tired of winning, hang in there because we're not done winning yet.
Wow, quite a declaration.
The crucial takeaway from this section is that the shift in regulatory stance is not just a passing phase. It's a foundational change that will profoundly impact the future of finance, bringing both exciting opportunities and significant new challenges for risk management.
Building on the technology underlying crypto, there's a big looming threat on the horizon that Barron's addressed. Quantum computing. Let's delve into quantum computing is a threat to Bitcoin. Crypto is ready to fight back.
The quantum threat, yes.
The article explains the core threat. Ultra-powerful quantum computers could eventually crack blockchain security codes, allowing hackers to steal bitcoins or even rewrite transaction history.
That's the nightmare scenario.
Absolutely. Aviva Litton of Gartner estimates roughly a quarter of all bitcoins, mostly older ones, could be vulnerable in 5 to 10 years. This includes Satoshi Nakamoto's estimated 1.1 million bitcoins, which are particularly at risk.
A huge chunk.
Quantum computers could do this by factoring large numbers hyper-efficiently, essentially picking a lock that would take a normal person millions of years.
Scary stuff.
BlackRock even included warnings in its Bitcoin ETF filings as far back as 2023, signaling institutional awareness of this significant threat.
Right, the institutions are paying attention. This raises the critical question of whether the crypto industry is truly ready for this. Well, Michael Osborne of IBM QuantumSafe suggests immediate fixes, like moving funds from old addresses to new wallets to protect them. But the long-term threat of disrupting mining and rewriting transaction history, that's much more profound. Some experts place the odds at 50% by 2037. It requires a significant industry-wide response.
So what's being done?
Developers aren't sitting idly by. There are strong incentives to protect the value in Bitcoin's network, leading to a digital arms race already underway.
A digital arms race, okay.
Quantinuum, a merger from Honeywell Quantum Solutions, is developing quantum-resistant technology, including a random number generator with cybersecurity applications. They even conducted an experiment with JPMorgan Chase to demonstrate how a quantum computer could outperform a classical machine in random number generation.
Showing progress.
Exactly, highlighting their progress. D-Wave Quantum is also approaching this challenge by developing a blockchain architecture that runs on quantum computers, aiming to replace traditional proof-of-work with a quantum proof-of-work for secure hashing.
Quantum proof-of-work. Interesting.
The underlying insight here is that the future of decentralized finance hinges not just on adoption, but on a proactive, rapid evolution of its core technological defenses against emerging threats like quantum computing.
The timeline for this is crucial and still quite uncertain. IBM suggests cryptographically relevant quantum computers could arrive in a decade, while others say it might take 12 years to become fully quantum resistant.
So not immediate, but not infinitely far off either.
Right. And for those in the crypto world, the article even nods to their famous motto, HODL, or hold on for dear life, almost as if Barron's is suggesting that might be the best strategy given this quantum threat, wouldn't you say?
Huh. Maybe so. Hold on tight.
Now, let's turn our attention to the fascinating world of technology beyond crypto. Barron's offers some intriguing insights, starting with Palo Alto Network's stock got hammered after CyberArk deal. Earnings offer a chance at redemption.
Penn W.
The article details how Palo Alto Network's stock was near a 52-week high before its announcement to acquire CyberArk software for a hefty $25 billion. Huge deal. The market's overreaction saw the stock tumble 5% on the deal announcement, and it's now down 15% to $165.90. This drop is largely attributed to the equity dilution from issuing over 100 million shares to finance the acquisition.
Right. Dilution always spooks the market initially.
Which effectively means existing shareholders now own a smaller piece of the combined company.
One surprising detail the article highlights is the disconnect between the market's initial reaction and the projected financials. Analysts actually expect an immediate earnings boost upon closing.
Immediate.
Yeah, with CyberArk's net income potentially lifting Palo Alto's by over 10%. The stock drop suggests market pessimism or uncertainty about how well the two companies will integrate their operations and technologies, the so-called synergies.
Right, the integration risk.
Which is precisely where the opportunity for new investors might lie. Analysts like Greg Moskowitz of Mizuho Securities called the deal highly synergistic, allowing Palo Alto to enter identity security and cross-sell products, potentially boosting Palo Alto's sales by more than current analyst expectations for CyberArk's revenue alone.
Okay, so potential upside there.
And Gray Powell of BTI sees substantial cost synergies, estimating that eliminating redundant costs could boost the combined company's operating profit margin to over 32% by 2028, up from just under 28% in 2026.
32% margin. That's strong.
Very strong. The real insight here is that sometimes the market's knee-jerk reaction to a large acquisition, particularly one involving equity, can create a short-term dislocation that smart investors can capitalize on if the long-term strategic rationale is sound.
The valuation of 46.28 times 12-month forward earnings might sound high for Palo Alto Networks, but it's actually closer to the low end of its five-year range for a high-growth sector like cybersecurity.
Right. Context is key for valuation multiples.
It seems the risks associated with the acquisition are already priced in, but the potential rewards from these synergies and expanded market presence are not yet fully recognized, making it an intriguing opportunity for those with a longer time horizon. Let's pivot to another tech play, this time in healthcare. Phreesia is turning profitable. Buy this small-cap healthcare tech leader.
Phreesia, hello.
This article introduces Phreesia as a leader in patient intake automation and digital engagement solutions, highlighting its rapid growth. They've nearly tripled their client base since their 2019 IPO, and last year alone, they facilitated approximately 170 million patient visits.
Huge volume. It's clearly a company with significant operational traction. This makes me curious about how they've managed to achieve profitability given the challenges in healthcare tech.
How did they do it?
Their business model, with nearly half of revenue from predictable subscriptions and a quarter from integrated payment solutions, provides a strong foundation for recurring revenue.
Okay, subscription model helps.
Definitely. But what's truly differentiating is their network solutions group, which leverages anonymized patient data for targeted advertising by top global drug makers.
Wow, the data play.
Exactly. This personalized approach could bypass some of the stricter regulatory scrutiny faced by mass media, as it's more direct and data-driven.
Interesting angle.
The company's financial turnaround is impressive. Revenue was up 15% year-over-year in Q1, and adjusted EBITDA reversed a loss to $54 million for the trailing 12 months. They've also set an ambitious fiscal year 2026 target of $85 million to $90 million EBITDA.
Big jump.
Which would be a substantial 138% increase from last year. CEO Chaim Indig highlighted how AI is enabling new capabilities, driving massive value for our clients and a return for our investors.
AI again?
The underlying insight here is how a company can carve out a highly profitable niche by leveraging data and AI to address a fundamental, often inefficient part of the healthcare experience, the patient intake process.
Analysts are certainly bullish, seeing more operating leverage, meaning their revenue growth is outpacing their cost growth, leading to higher profit margins and significant long-term potential in a $10 billion addressable market.
That's a big market to grow into.
This company, with a healthy balance sheet, looks like a compelling small-cap tech leader poised for continued growth as healthcare digitalization accelerates. Shifting gears, the Microsoft Palantir Get Analyst Attention section summarizes recent investment and research firm reports, giving us a rapid snapshot of what's moving the needle for big tech and beyond.
Okay, quick hits.
For Microsoft, D.A. Davidson has a buy rating with a $650 target. Their analysis focuses on OpenAI's GPT-OSS open source release and Microsoft's tight commercial relationship with OpenAI.
Still the OpenAI factor.
Which is driving significant gains in Azure's outperformance over hyperscaler peers. Then there's Palantir Technologies, which Deutsche Bank rates as a hold with a $160 target.
Still hold despite the revenue multiple.
Now, despite the hold rating, the report highlights impressive results with accelerating revenue growth, especially U.S. commercial, up 93% year over year.
93%, wow.
Rising backlog and margin expansion. They also noted record annual contract value and lifted full-year guidance.
Okay, so strong fundamentals, even with a hold.
And it's not just tech getting this attention. Morgan Stanley upgraded Globe Life to overweight with a $160 target, emphasizing a shift in their thesis to capital and earnings growth after DOJ investigations concluded, with an improving capital outlook due to Bermuda developments.
Ooh, regulatory overhang clearing up.
For Planet Fitness, Stifel issued a buy rating with a $120 target, discussing strong Q2 2025 results with impressive comparable store sales growth and an adjusted EBITDA beat. They addressed the stock drop due to click-to-cancel attrition being overblown, as it's reflected in guidance.
So manageable churn.
Pointing to future growth drivers. On the other hand, UBS maintained a neutral rating for Novo Nordisk with a $53.3 target, detailing a very challenging equity story.
Competition heating up in weight loss drugs.
Seems like it, including competition from GLP-1 compounders, a perceived lack of commercial execution, Ozempic plateauing, and the uncertainty around President Trump's proposal to reimburse GLP-1 in Medicare, potentially reducing value.
A lot of headwinds there.
Lastly, Seaport Research Partners gave Shopify a buy rating with a $167 target, highlighting a clean beat across the board in Q2. Strong gross merchandise volume growth, especially internationally, and positive Q3 guidance, emphasizing strong operating momentum.
Shopify's still looking strong. If we connect this to the bigger picture, these analyst reports offer a quick snapshot of what sophisticated investors are thinking.
Right.
They reflect a market that's still very much focused on growth, particularly in areas like AI and cloud services, but also discerning about where that growth is sustainable and how policy changes might impact it.
Hmm.
The key query that emerges from this is, how do these individual company narratives fit into the broader market trends we just discussed about inflation and tariffs?
Good question.
The ability to see the micro stories of company performance alongside the macroeconomic forces is crucial for forming a holistic investment view.
That brings us to a crucial point, and it leads us directly into our next section, where Barron's delves into broader market dynamics and investment strategies. The piece, stocks are rich. This investment pro says there's plenty of cash on the sidelines, offers a compelling counter-narrative to some of the market frothiness we just discussed.
Okay, the bullish case.
Seems so. It introduces Jack Ablin, chief investment strategist of Crescent, in his view that while the S&P 500 is about 27% overvalued,
27% overvalued, wow,
stocks can still climb. His key argument rests on the more than $7 trillion currently sitting in money market funds, yielding around 4.5%.
That's a mountain of cash.
It is. He believes that a slight drop in that yield could prompt investors to redeploy this cash into equities, fueling further market gains, a sort of cash on the sidelines effect.
The classic cash on the sidelines argument. One particularly striking aspect of this report is Ablin's perspective on investor psychology. He notes how overwhelming bullishness or bearishness can often be a contrary indicator.
Right, the contrarian view.
Yeah, meaning when everyone is leaning one way, the market might do the opposite. He observed extreme bearishness during the Liberation Day uncertainty, which often precedes rallies, challenging the notion of uniform market complacency we discussed earlier.
So maybe not total complacency.
Maybe not. Ablin also notes that initial fears about tariffs causing earnings growth estimates to be slashed from 13.5% down to 6.5% were likely overblown, as announced tariffs have been lower than feared.
Okay.
He now expects earnings expectations to rise as analysts reassess their original forecasts, despite potential margin compression in the second half of the year.
So earnings could surprise to the upside.
That's his point. Even with high valuations, there are still catalysts and shifts in sentiment that can drive markets higher.
Ablin also has strong opinions on leadership within companies. He's a big believer in founder CEOs.
Yes, he makes a compelling case. He points to dramatic differences in stock performance under founder versus non-founder CEOs, citing examples like Steve Jobs at Apple.
The classic example.
Where the stock saw a 33% annual return during his tenure versus Tim Cook's 18% since taking over. Or Larry Page at Google delivering 27% annually compared to Sundar Pichai's 15%.
Those are big differences.
They really are. The reasoning is simple. Founders often have a deeper understanding of the business and its culture, and an enormous stake that directly aligns their wealth with company performance, as that stake often represents a huge portion of their personal wealth.
Right, skin in the game.
Exactly. This raises an important question. Are we as investors and boards over-indexing on professional management at the expense of vision and intrinsic motivation that often comes with the founder?
Interesting thought.
Ablin also discusses his three phases of innovation. Hardware, like NVIDIA's chips, platform, like Google's AI models, and beneficiary.
Okay, the phases.
He argues that the biggest returns will come from beneficiary companies outside the core AI field that harness AI to transform their businesses.
So not just the AI makers.
Right. Much like Amazon used the internet to transform retail, rather than just the companies building the foundational AI tech, this suggests a broader, more diversified approach to AI investing.
Ablin also offers practical advice on portfolio construction, especially for clients with significant wealth. It seems he advocates for a nuanced, goals-based approach.
He certainly does. He advocates for a goals-based investing approach, arranging asset allocation by time horizons.
Time horizons, okay.
This means segmenting investments for liquidity, 0-3 years for immediate needs, diversified income, 3-7 years for predictable cash flow, growth, 7-15 years for wealth appreciation, and aspirational 15+ years for long-term higher risk reward opportunities.
Makes sense to break it down like that.
For the diversified income segment, he specifically favors private markets like core private credit, which involves direct lending to companies and can offer attractive yields.
Private credit becoming more mainstream.
Definitely. And satellite private credit, encompassing royalties and leases. These offer an income focus and aren't as reliant on public capital markets, providing diversification from traditional bonds and stocks. This highlights the growing importance of private market access for sophisticated investors and how it's becoming a key component of modern wealth management for income generation.
This naturally leads us to another article. 5% yields are hard to find. 4 dividend stocks you can count on.
The hunt for yield.
It explains the decline in average S&P 500 dividend yields, which have fallen from 3-4% in the 80s to less than 1.25% now.
Quite a drop.
This is largely driven by corporate preference for stock buybacks, which are more tax efficient and boost earnings per share, and by rising stock prices, which compress yields.
Right, buybacks over dividends.
So what does this all mean for someone seeking dependable income? Barron's screen for companies with at least a 5% yield, a payout ratio under 75% of free cash flow, and expected earnings growth of at least 5%. What did they find after applying these stringent filters?
Well, they found just 4 names, a significant drop from 9 earlier in the year.
Only 4. Wow.
Only 4. Underscoring how difficult it is to find high-yield blue chips that meet these stringent criteria in the current market, those were Bristol-Myers Squibb, which has a 5.4% yield.
Okay. BMS?
Despite its stock being down 20% this year due to pipeline worries, it comfortably covers its dividend and trades at a cheap 7x forward earnings.
7x is cheap.
Then there's Edison International, with the highest yield at 6%. Despite wildfire liability concerns, it's expected to continue its impressive 21-year streak of dividend increases.
21 years, that's consistency.
A testament to its stability. Prudential Financial also made the list with a 5.2% yield. Though its stock has languished, analysts expect strong earnings growth to cover its dividend.
Okay, approve.
Finally, Interpublic Group with a 5.3% yield. This yield is likely to drop due to its acquisition by Omnicom.
The acquisition factor.
But Interpublic shareholders will receive Omnicom shares, which has a respectable 4.1% yield. The key query that emerges from this search is how to identify genuine quality in a high-yield environment.
Right. Yield isn't everything.
Exactly. As Jack Ablum points out, in an environment where profit margins might be pressured, owning companies with adequate cash flow that don't rely on capital markets to fund growth and which have consistently grown their dividends becomes even more critical for long-term stability and income for a diversified portfolio.
We also saw a fascinating shift in a major public pension fund strategy, highlighted in Virginia's pension sells Walmart stock, buys Carnival, Airbnb.
The pension fund's making moves.
Okay. The Virginia Retirement System, a substantial fund with $114.3 billion in assets, made significant portfolio adjustments in Q2 2025. They drastically increased their stake in Carnival.
Betting on travel.
More than halved their investment in Walmart and doubled down on Airbnb.
Yeah.
What's the story behind these seemingly divergent moves?
Well, this provides a great example of active management reflecting changing market conditions and evolving sentiment within specific sectors. Carnival, for instance, has seen its stock rise 13% in the first half of 2025.
Okay, performing well.
Buoyed by strong earnings and leadership commenting on its tremendous value compared to land-based alternatives. This indicates a bullish outlook on the travel and leisure sector, perhaps anticipating a continued post-pandemic rebound.
Makes sense.
Walmart, despite reporting strong earnings, hasn't seen much stock movement since April, leading VRS to reduce its exposure, perhaps signaling a belief that its near-term upside is limited despite its strong fundamentals and defensive qualities.
Okay, trimming Walmart.
Meanwhile, Airbnb, which was flat in the first half, received a doubled investment from VRS. This move likely represents a bet on its significant $200 million to $250 million investment in customer experience initiatives like Airbnb Originals.
Ah, the Originals investment.
Which are designed to enhance its platform and attract more users, potentially signaling a long-term growth play. The natural next thought here is what this tells us about the short-term market sentiment towards consumer spending and travel.
Experiences over goods.
It seems investors are betting on experiences over everyday retail for growth. Finally, the issue also included a brief section on activist investing, highlighting actions like GAMCO investors raising its stake in Paramount Global to over 12%.
GAMCO getting involved.
And Value Act increasing its stake in Rocket Co's with prior engagement with management regarding board representation. Activist investing often signals perceived undervaluation or opportunities for strategic change within a company.
Shaking things up.
Giving us a glimpse into potential battles for corporate control and significant shifts in company direction, driven by a desire to unlock shareholder value.
Before we delve into specific industry deep dives, I want to take a moment to address a sector that's been quietly but significantly reshaping itself. Defense stocks.
Ah, defense. Yes.
The original outline for this deep dive mentioned the surprising dynamics of defense stocks. And while it wasn't a dedicated article in this specific issue, the broader trends are certainly something Barron's would be tracking. And it's a critical area for informed investors.
Absolutely.
The geopolitical landscape has shifted dramatically, driving new considerations for defense companies and their investors.
That's an excellent point to bring up. The dynamics in the defense sector today are indeed fascinating, largely driven by, well, persistent global tensions.
Right, unfortunately.
We're seeing increased defense spending across many nations, fueled by conflicts, rising cyber threats, and a renewed focus on national security. This sustained demand provides a strong tailwind for traditional defense contractors.
The Lockheeds, the Raytheons.
Exactly. But it's not just about building more jets or tanks. There's a significant shift towards advanced technologies.
Like what?
For example, companies are heavily investing in AI for predictive analytics, quantum computing for secure communications, and sophisticated cyber warfare capabilities.
Okay, so defense meets tech.
Precisely. This means that defense companies are increasingly becoming technology companies. The real puzzle for investors is how to balance the long, stable government contract cycles with the rapid pace of technological innovation.
That's tricky.
It is. Companies that can bridge that gap, integrating cutting-edge tech with reliable production, are the ones likely to see sustained growth.
So we're not just talking about the Lockheed Martins and Raytheons of the world, but potentially newer players or divisions focused on these next-gen capabilities.
That's part of it, yeah.
What are some of the broader implications for supply chains and for the investor looking at this sector, beyond just the obvious demand drivers?
Exactly. While the established giants certainly dominate, their strategic investments are increasingly in these digital and advanced capabilities, sometimes through acquisitions of smaller, innovative tech firms.
Okay, M&A activity.
Right. The implications for supply chains are profound. There's a push for greater domestic production and diversification away from single points of failure, especially for critical components like semiconductors and rare earth minerals.
Reshoring and friendshoring.
Exactly. This desire for reshoring or friendshoring is driven by geopolitical risk, but it also introduces higher costs and potentially longer development cycles.
Trade-offs.
Always trade-offs. For the investor, the key insight is to look beyond just the top-line revenue growth in defense. It's crucial to analyze a company's investment in R&D, its intellectual property portfolio in areas like AI and quantum, and its ability to adapt to evolving threats.
So dig deeper than the headlines.
Definitely. Furthermore, the defense sector often offers a degree of counter-cyclical stability when other parts of the economy are struggling, given its reliance on government budgets rather than consumer spending. This makes it an interesting diversification play, especially in an unpredictable economic climate. ##6, industry spotlights and corporate health checks.
Now let's turn to some deeper dives into specific industries and company-level health checks from this week's Barron's. The media world is always in flux, and this week Barron's covered a big one. Paramount's merger was a bad deal for old shareholders. The stock is a good bet for new ones.
Ah, the Paramount saga continues.
Indeed. The article details the completion of Skydance Media's purchase of Paramount, forming Paramount, a Skydance corporation, with a new ticker, PSKY.
New ticker, new era.
We'll see. It laments Paramount's disastrous past decade. Shares down 75%, burning investors like Warren Buffett, who reportedly took a 50% hit on a $3 billion position.
Ouch. Big hit for Buffett.
It was characterized as a bad deal for old shareholders because Class B shareholders cashed out half their stock at $15, while the controlling Redstone family and Class A holders received a significant premium.
Right, the controversial structure of that deal.
The article also notes that Paramount appeared to overpay for Skydance, a relatively small player with projected revenue of $2.3 billion against Paramount's $28 billion.
The surprising element here is the clean slate argument the article makes for new investors, despite all the baggage of the messy deal.
A clean slate? How so?
David Ellison, the new CEO and son of Oracle's Larry Ellison, brings deep pockets. Larry's net worth is estimated at $300 billion, and perhaps more importantly, an outsider's perspective and tech sensibility to an industry often described as badly run.
The tech sensibility angle. Interesting.
See, this certainly makes one wonder. Can a new leader with significant backing truly revive a struggling media giant, particularly one that has been so entrenched in traditional media?
That's the billion-dollar question, isn't it?
Or maybe $300 billion question. Ellison's vision is to create a leaner, faster, smarter, and more agile company, with aims to cut $2 billion annually. He has even expressed confidence to meaningfully exceed that target, as seen in the recent, rather public, cancellation of the Stephen Colbert Show.
Yeah, that made headlines.
Which saves an estimated $40 million annually. Speculation abounds about strategic options, including spinning off cable networks, merging properties, or selling CBS TV stations. However, Ellison's letter suggests doubling down, supercharging creative engines, and scaling Paramount Plus Quip.
So cutting costs, but also trying to grow the core.
Seems like the plan. The core insight here is that while past performance was dismal, a drastic change in leadership and significant new capital, combined with a willingness to make tough decisions, can create a completely new investment thesis for a seemingly broken company.
Despite this new optimism, Wall Street is still largely skeptical, with only 3 out of 25 analysts rating it a buy.
Still a lot of doubters.
But the stock's valuation is inexpensive at 6x annualized operating income. And there's even speculation the Ellison family could buy out the public shareholders, given their relatively small public float of just over $3 billion.
Which is pocket change for Larry Ellison.
Pretty much. Only about 1% of the Ellison family's reported net worth. This combination of potential catalysts and low valuation makes it a compelling turnaround story to watch. Next, we have a story that sounds like it's straight out of a soap opera, but with Kiefer. A family feud leaves the future of this Kiefer king in doubt. Danone may take over.
Kiefer and family feuds. Okay.
This article introduces Lifeway Foods as the Kiefer king, dominating 95% of the U.S. market, with sales nearly doubling in 5 years to $186.8 million in 2024, thanks to the surging popularity of protein and probiotic-rich foods.
Market leader, definitely. This makes me reflect on the unique pitfalls of family businesses.
What are those pitfalls here?
The article details a multi-year family feud between CEO Julie Smolyansky and her mother Lucy and brother Edward, who was fired in 2022 amidst allegations of inappropriate conduct and intoxication, which he denies.
Wow, messy.
Very messy. This internal conflict has escalated into 5 lawsuits and even restraining orders, highlighting the intense personal stakes involved. Compensation has also been a contentious point, with Edward criticizing Julie's $2 million retention bonus and her husband's pay package.
So fighting over control and money?
Pretty much. Edward's activist campaign argues that Lifeway could perform better despite its recent profitability, suggesting the internal strife is holding it back. The crucial takeaway for any investor is that strong fundamentals in a family business can be overshadowed or even undermined by unresolved internal conflicts, making governance and succession planning paramount.
This is where the plot thickens. This internal strife has drawn the attention of French conglomerate Danone, which has owned over a fifth of Lifeway since 1999.
Danone circling.
Right.
Danone made 2 acquisition offers last year at $25 and $27 a share, which Lifeway rejected, believing it undervalued the company.
But they thought they were worth more.
But now, Danone has signed a confidentiality agreement to review a potential acquisition, with a deadline of September 15th. Crucially, Danone announced its intention to support Lucy and Edward's proposal to oust the entire Lifeway board if a deal isn't reached by the deadline.
So Danone is putting the pressure on.
Big time. This effectively puts Julie and the current board in an unenviable position, risking a hostile takeover if they don't agree to terms. The natural next thought here is what the future truly holds for Lifeway and the Smolyansky family, given Danone's significant leverage and the deep personal divides that have plagued the company for years.
Yeah, what happens next?
It's a classic example of how external corporate interest can force a resolution, for better or worse, in a deeply entrenched family dispute.
Now let's transition to the retail sector, starting with Kohl's has bigger problems than the meme stock trade.
Ah, Kohl's.
The article explains Kohl's brief surge, which was up nearly 50% in mid-July, due to meme stock traders targeting its heavily shorted shares with nearly 40% short interest.
The meme stock effect, yeah. Fleeting.
Very fleeting. But this fleeting attention doesn't solve Kohl's fundamental problems. The company has seen 13 consecutive quarters of declining same-store sales.
13 quarters. Ouch.
Shrinking profitability and frequent management turmoil. 5 CEOs in 10 years. It's like a revolving door of leadership, each reversing the prior strategy, which can be incredibly disruptive.
You're right. The consistent management turnover is a huge red flag. The article notes former CEO Tom Kingsbury's shift to an off-price model alienated core customers.
Right, losing your base.
And his successor was fired for conflict of interest issues. This makes me wonder, can a retailer truly recover lost market share when loyal customers are fired and younger shoppers increasingly prefer specialty stores or online options?
Tough challenge.
Despite the skepticism from analysts like Chuck Grom, who sees it as really hard, some bullish investors see value in Kohl's real estate assets.
The real estate play.
Which could be worth more than its $1.3 billion market cap, making it an attractive takeover target. The core insight here is that for a legacy retailer like Kohl's, even a meme stock surge can't mask fundamental business model challenges and the difficulty of regaining consumer relevance in a rapidly evolving retail landscape.
Moving from retail giants to a brand known for its rugged coolers, and now, surprisingly, its drinkware. Yeti might be out of the woods after a drinkware spill.
Yeah, okay.
The article starts with a relatable personal anecdote about accumulating massive insulated water bottles, something many of us can relate to.
Guilty as charged.
Yeti's drinkware now accounts for over half its business, but net sales recently fell 4%. What's happening here?
Well, the company blamed a more promotional drinkware environment, suggesting a crowded market and increased competition.
Everyone has an insulated tumbler now.
Pretty much. However, the article highlights that management trimmed sales guidance, but raised profit guidance.
Interesting. Raised profit guidance.
Yeah, indicating effective navigation of the drinkware spill by managing costs or improving product mix. The stock has fallen significantly from its 2021 peak of over $100 down to $32.
Big drop.
But its valuation's down to 12 times next year's projected earnings. Free cash flow is healthy, and the company is launching 30 new products this year, including soft-sided coolers and luggage.
Diversifying beyond drinkware, then.
Exactly. This makes me wonder, can new product innovation and expanding into adjacent categories keep a brand like Yeti on Wall Street's radar when its core growth area faces headwinds and consumer preferences are constantly evolving?
Can they keep the magic alive?
The company's ability to maintain profitability even with sales dips points to strong brand loyalty and pricing power, which are crucial attributes for long-term survival in a competitive consumer goods market.
Moving to corporate governance and executive insights, Barron's covers spending for executive protection is on the rise.
Executive security.
Right. This article highlights a sharp increase in security spending for top executives.
Huh.
In 2024, 34% of executives at the 500 largest U.S. public companies received security perks, up from 23% in 2020.
That's a big jump.
The median spend more than doubled to $106,500. The biggest jumps were in tech and communication services, with NVIDIA's spend soaring to $2.2 million and ServiceNow's to $2.1 million.
Millions on security. Wow.
But it's not just tech. It seems to be a broader trend.
Paul Donahue of Constellis points out that industries and brands that are deeply embedded in the daily lives of citizens are more likely to be focal points for security concerns, including healthcare, oil and gas, utilities, automotive, and food suppliers.
Okay, so broader than just tech CEOs.
Yeah. The horrific Park Avenue shootings in April, which killed security personnel and executives, underscore this security paranoia and the very real dangers executives can face.
A tragic reminder.
The core insight here is that escalating executive security costs are not just a luxury perk. They reflect a growing recognition of genuine threats and the increasing burden on corporations to ensure the safety of their leadership. This raises an important question about the broader societal and corporate governance implications of such rapidly escalating executive security costs. How does this impact the risk profile of companies, and how is it justified to shareholders?
Speaking of corporate insights, one fascinating signal Barron's highlighted this week was the insider buying at UPS. The article, UPS CEO Carol Tomei Buys the Stock Dip, details some interesting insider action at UPS.
Insider buying, always interesting.
Where CEO Carol Tomei and board chair William Johnson both bought significant shares after the stock tumbled 11% following an earnings miss.
Buying the dip themselves.
Tomei spent $1 million on 11,682 shares, and Johnson bought over $430,000 worth.
That's real money. This is a classic signal of insider confidence, often viewed as a strong bullish indicator.
Right.
Despite UPS stock being down significantly this year and for the past 4 years, their purchases suggest a belief that the recent dip is a buying opportunity and that the company's long-term prospects remain strong.
So they see value others aren't.
It suggests that. Tomei last bought stock in May 2020 and Johnson in July 2024. This makes one wonder, what can we infer about management's outlook when they put their own money on the line during challenging times, especially when the company has been facing a consistent decline in its stock price?
What can we infer?
It often signals a strong belief in an impending turnaround or a deep conviction in the company's intrinsic value, as management typically has the most informed view of their company's internal health and future prospects.
Let's dive deeper into the impact of AI, especially on the labor market. The article, AI isn't to blame if your college grad can't find a job. Look to this trend instead. Offers a surprising perspective.
Okay, challenging the AI narrative.
It challenges the plausible dystopian narrative that AI is stealing jobs from recent college graduates, with Will Raderman of the Niskanen Center calling the evidence thin.
Thin evidence. Interesting. The striking detail here is the data that challenges popular perception. While AI adoption is certainly growing from 3.7% of firms in September 2023 to 9.4% in July, it's largely concentrated in the information sector.
Which is pretty small overall.
Exactly. Only employs about 2% of U.S. workers. The real culprit, according to Carrie Freestone of RBC, is a skills mismatch.
A skills mismatch.
This makes me wonder, are educational institutions aligning with the evolving needs of the labor market?
Good question. How bad is the mismatch?
The article explains this mismatch. Nearly half of recent degrees are in business, social sciences, and computer science, but the majority of job openings from retiring workers are in service sector roles like janitors, maintenance, personal care aides, and construction.
Roles that often don't require those degrees.
Precisely. Furthermore, job listings in top industries for new grads, like IT, engineering, healthcare, and financial services, are declining, while the cost of entry-level hires is rising.
So fewer traditional grad jobs.
Right. The key insight is that the issue isn't necessarily a lack of jobs overall, but a fundamental misalignment between the skills graduates possess and the skills the economy actually needs in many high-demand sectors.
This sounds like a structural problem that could get worse before it gets better, suggesting weaker summer employment reports ahead for college graduates as this mismatch continues to widen.
It's a definite challenge.
It's a challenging situation for young people entering the workforce. Now, let's turn to a sector that's been struggling. Healthcare. Barron's article is titled, Healthcare Stocks Have Been Beaten Up, The Case for Buying Now.
Healthcare. Yeah, it's been lagging. You're right. The healthcare sector has been the sick man of the S&P 500 this year, falling 3.7% while the broader market gained.
Sick man.
Every corner of the sector, from insurers facing sky-high reimbursement costs to pharma dealing with drug price pressures and FDA changes, has felt the pain. Even Eli Lilly, the obesity drug giant, has stumbled recently.
Even Lilly, wow.
This makes one ask, why is Barron's making a case for buying now?
Yeah, why buy into the weakness?
Well, the bullish arguments include the healthcare ETF stabilizing around $130, a historical support level, and remaining in a long-term uptrend.
Okay, technical support.
There are also individual stock signs of life, like Pfizer beating estimates and Merck resisting further drops. Critically, valuations are attractive. The healthcare ETF trades at just over 16 times expected aggregate earnings.
15 times isn't bad for healthcare.
No, it's a 27% discount to the S&P 500, which is double the decade average discount. Plus, the sector is expected to see 11% annual earnings growth in the next 2 years, driven by Lilly's obesity business and medical device makers.
So growth potential is still there.
Exactly. The core insight is that despite current headwinds, the fundamental demand drivers for healthcare are immense and long-term, making the current undervaluation a potential buying opportunity for patient investors.
It seems the risk-reward in healthcare stocks is looking quite appealing, despite the current struggles. It's a sector that often performs defensively and provides long-term growth. Let's transition to the world of fixed income. Rates are falling. It's time to rethink your bond strategy.
Bonds. Okay. The bond market is reacting significantly to economic cooling and the surprising move of the yield curve steepening.
Right. The curve steepening is interesting.
The 10-year Treasury yield dropped to 4.25% and could go lower, potentially to 4% this year. This makes me consider a crucial question for you, the investor. What should you do with your cash and fixed income portfolio now?
Yeah, what's the move?
Michael Arone of State Street suggests extending maturities to 5 to 7 years in treasuries to capture most of the yield without the extreme volatility of longer bonds.
Okay, intermediate duration.
For added yield, alternative strategies include core bond funds that diversify, private credit kickers like the SPDR SSGA IG Public and Private Credit ETF, which yields 4.4%.
Private credit again.
And collateralized loan obligations, or CLOs, via ETFs like the BondBlocks Private Credit CLO ETF, yielding in the 8% range.
8% is attractive, but what's the risk?
Good question. To ensure we all fully grasp this, CLOs are essentially bundles of leveraged loans made to companies, sliced into different risk tranches. Their high yield reflects the underlying risk and complexity. They're not treasuries.
Got it. More complex.
Triple B-rated corporate bonds also offer higher yield with less volatility than junk bonds, and municipal bonds are attractive for tax-conscious investors, as are non-agency residential mortgage-backed securities.
Lots of options beyond just treasuries.
Definitely. The essential takeaway here is that as yields fall, simply holding cash becomes less attractive. And a thoughtful bond strategy involving diversification and perhaps a slight extension of maturity can still deliver competitive after-inflation returns.
It sounds like bonds, despite recent yield drops, still offer attractive after-inflation returns, especially compared to money market funds whose competitive 4% yields are likely to fall further.
Exactly.
It means holding excess cash is not a good long-term strategic allocation in this environment. Now, a significant development in the private equity space. Interval funds charge big fees. Vanguard is looking to challenge that.
Interval funds.
Right.
What's truly captivating here is the unique structure of interval funds. They allow quarterly redemptions, typically 5% of assets.
Limited liquidity then.
Right, which enables managers to invest in illiquid assets like private equity, venture capital, and private debt assets traditionally exclusive to large institutions. These funds are now accessible to retail investors for as little as $1,000, democratizing access to private markets.
Okay, access for the masses.
But the problem highlighted is the gouging. The median interval fund charges a whopping 3.02% total expense ratio.
3%. Ouch.
And even 2.18% excluding leverage, which eats significantly into returns. This certainly makes me wonder, can Vanguard, known for its low-cost index funds, disrupt this high-fee environment and bring down costs for the average investor?
Can the Vanguard effect work here too?
That's the hope. The significance of Vanguard partnering with Wellington Management and Blackstone to launch the WVB All Markets Fund is huge. While fees are yet to be disclosed, they are widely expected to be far more reasonable.
Competition driving down fees.
Though academic research suggests little return premium for illiquid assets before fees and leverage compared to public alternatives, with leverage, interval funds have outperformed. The key insight is that Vanguard's entry could be a game changer, forcing a much-needed compression of fees in a space traditionally dominated by high-cost exclusive offerings.
This move by Vanguard and Capital Group, also entering the space with more reasonable fees, is a very welcome development for retail investors looking to access these private markets without being gouged.
Absolutely. More choice, lower fees.
It's a sign that the industry is slowly becoming more accessible and transparent. Finally, let's look at strategies for navigating market volatility. The market will panic again. Use these option strategies to profit.
Ah, profiting from panic. This article presents a powerful underlying bullish thesis for stocks despite volatile government data.
Bullish even with panic.
Yeah. It highlights three key reasons. Strong corporate earnings growth, renewed hopes for lower interest rates with Fed Chair Powell on the defensive, and the fundamental investor drive to value making money above all else.
Okay.
This makes me consider, for you, the listener, how can you strategically position yourself in a market that's prone to periodic panic rather than being swept up in it?
Right. How to use the volatility.
The article introduces two strategies for bullish investors with a long-term horizon. First, selling put options.
Selling puts. Okay.
Think of it like this. You're agreeing to potentially buy a stock at a lower price if it drops, and in exchange for taking on that obligation, you get paid a premium up front.
Getting paid to wait to buy.
Exactly. If the stock never hits that lower price, you just keep the premium. It's a way to generate income or buy a stock you like at a discount if the market dips.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second strategy?
Second, call option spreads. This involves buying one call option and simultaneously selling another with a higher strike price and the same expiration.
A spread, right. Less risk than just buying a call.
Exactly. This strategy mitigates risk while positioning for stock gains with potential 100% returns and is illustrated with an example using the Invesco QQQ Trust, which tracks the NASDAQ 100.
Okay.
The core insight here is that smart investors don't just react to panic. They anticipate it and strategically position themselves to capitalize on the opportunities it creates.
The core message here is that while volatility is inevitable, for those with a long-term perspective, that which doesn't kill stocks makes them stronger. A powerful thought indeed. #tagoutro. What a journey through Barron's magazine for the week of August 11th, 2025.
Quite a week.
We've seen a dizzying array of developments, from the political embrace of crypto and its potential risks to the strategic pivots in major companies like Paramount and Lifeway, the quiet but crucial shifts in defense spending, and critical shifts in investment approaches for bonds and private markets.
And we've unpacked the nuances of inflation, the complex impact of tariffs, and even a deeper look at the true challenges facing new college graduates. The overarching theme, it seems, is one of constant adaptation.
Adaptation is key.
Whether it's companies navigating new competitive landscapes or investors adjusting their strategies to an economy in flux.
So what does this all mean for you, our listener?
Well, this brings to mind an important question for you to mull over. In a world where economic data, corporate strategies, and even the very nature of money are undergoing such rapid transformation, how do you balance the short-term noise and the inevitable moments of market panic with the long-term opportunities that are consistently emerging?
Balancing act.
Perhaps the key is not to predict every twist and turn, but to cultivate a deeper understanding of the underlying forces at play, allowing you to, well, ride the waves rather than be swept away by them.
A truly thought-provoking challenge. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Barron's Magazine. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
And I'm Alex Astor. We look forward to diving deeper with you next time on The Deep Dive.